Blog Talk Radio.
Pour yourself a cup of tea, put your feet up, and relax. Show host Randy Fine, narcissistic abuse expert, compassionate counselor for clients worldwide, and author of the groundbreaking new book, Close Encounters of the Worst Kind, invites you into her sanctuary, a place where your emotional, physical, and spiritual well-being are all that matters. Time to Heal is a fundraising single written and performed by Johnny Z for the Amy Winehouse Foundation. For more information, please go to johnnymusic.com, johnnymusic.com. And now, it's time to meet Randy, show host of the podcast enjoyed by fans around the globe, A Fine Time for Healing.
Good morning. Thank you for tuning in to listen to A Fine Time for Healing. I am your radio show host, Randy Fine. Today we are going to be talking about summer seasonal affective disorder. We've heard of the one in winter called SAD, but we're going to talk about something different. People usually, when they refer to SAD, refer to the wintertime depression. But what you might not know is that for some people, SAD can also apply to summertime depression. When most of us are looking forward to fun in the sun, for those who suffer from summer onset SAD, life could be anything but enjoyable. Today's special guest, Dr. Vinay Saranga. He has been with us before, a psychiatrist and founder of Saranga Comprehensive Psychiatry. He says reverse SAD is real. It's not about being a party pooper. Summer depression can really bring some people down. The sun, to them, is utterly oppressive. It drains and exhausts them. They are energized on cloudy days. This type of exhaustion can isolate people and intensify feelings of sadness and anxiety. So I'm going to welcome Dr. Saranga to the show, and we will get started. Good morning, Dr. Saranga. How are you?
Good morning, Randy. I'm good, thanks. Thanks for having me on the show today.
Good. Welcome back. It's good to have you.
Thank you. Thank you.
So, you know, I used to live up north. Now I live in Florida. I used to live up north, but I had terrible SAD every winter, starting in the fall. And I even had a light box that I would use. Now that I'm down here, I don't have the same problem. So can you explain to us exactly what SAD is and how it can affect us?
Yeah. SAD is basically an acronym for seasonal affective disorder, which is basically a type of depression that typically happens around the winter months. And that's a classical seasonal affective disorder that you'll hear about, is when there's less sunlight outside and more kind of cloudiness, and the days are kind of dreary and short, and so for the folks such as yourself that did struggle with that, typically we would recommend a light box to use, which basically you would use it for a certain amount of time every day to kind of increase the light exposure, since from outdoors you're really not getting the amount of light that you need to help improve your mood. So, so it typically happens around the winter months in most folks, and it does present with the typical depressive types of symptoms, which can be low energy, trouble concentrating, changes in sleep, which could be having trouble sleeping or sleeping too much, changes in appetite, the appetite could go up or down. Each person is a little different as far as that goes when they're depressed. Low energy, trouble concentrating. And these are all kind of the typical symptoms that you would see in depression, but also with folks who have seasonal affective disorder or depression that happens just seasonally. Typically, the classical, as I mentioned, is in the wintertime.
Okay, and so what exactly are we lacking in the winter that would affect people that way? Besides sun,
typically,
I mean, okay, is it a vitamin or, what are we lacking?
Vitamin D is one of the, it's an important vitamin that's kind of lacking, and that's what we typically obtain from sunlight exposure. And sunlight helps us produce vitamin D, which can help improve our mood. And so that's really one of the major mechanisms or theories behind why seasonal affective disorder occurs, but also other neurotransmitters that are typically associated with depression are serotonin and norepinephrine. So low levels of serotonin and norepinephrine in the brain can lead to depression, anxiety symptoms. So there's kind of three major ones, but what's associated with kind of the seasonal depression piece is more the vitamin D and low levels of vitamin D because of lack of sunlight in folks who do have the classical wintertime seasonal affective disorder.
Okay. So I wasn't aware that people can have a similar disorder in the summer, but it mm-hmm. would not be related to the same thing. So explain to us what summertime SAD is.
It's a relatively rare phenomenon because typically the seasonal affective disorder typically happens in about 5 to 8% of the population, but only 10% of those folks would actually experience the seasonal affective symptoms in the summertime instead of the wintertime. So we really don't know a whole lot about why this phenomenon occurs, and I wish we did. So there's still a lot to learn about why this subset of folks are experiencing these symptoms in the summer, even though there is good exposure to sunlight versus not having those symptoms in the wintertime. Theoretically, there are potentially a lot of explanations to it. And, one could be a routine, so a change in routine in the summertime. So summertime is pretty unstructured for most folks. You're going on vacations, kids are out of school, so that routine is thrown off for the kids. Sometimes the sleep cycle gets kind of thrown off because we're, maybe going to sleep later at night or sleeping in. So with vacations, a lot of people are traveling too, and sometimes that leads to a time change when you travel. So that kind of throws off our sleep cycle even more. Sometimes some other stressors typically could be some financial stressors too, but with traveling, because traveling for many people can be a pretty expensive ordeal, and so that can be an added stress for many families.
Okay. So symptoms are the same, but the disorder is kind of different, although they still call it seasonal affective disorder.
Correct.
And so it sounds to me like it's related more to behavior our behavior changes than it is to a lack of something. Am I right? Or
right.
am I not getting it?
Right. It could be, yeah, right. It could be a behavioral, but also, we could say, since we really don't know a whole lot about it, we could set aside the vitamin D piece that I was talking about in folks that maybe such as yourself that struggled with it in the wintertime, because obviously typically you're getting enough vitamin D, but in the summer, but the days are longer in the summer, which sometimes can lead to throwing off your sleep cycle as well, because it's harder to fall asleep sometimes if there's still some sunlight outside. Or if you live in a, I'll give you an example. We went on a trip to Alaska over this past summer. And so in Alaska, in the summertime, and most of those northern states or even countries, I was in Norway last year. So they have sometimes up to 20 something hours of sunlight in the summertime. So it's interesting, because you would be, even at like midnight, it wouldn't be completely dark. It would be at least some sunlight, and it's really kind of tough to fall asleep. And then when you in the morning, like so the sunlight would come, the bright sun you would see sometimes as early as like 6 o'clock in the morning. So it that really kind of throws off your sleep cycle a bit. Aside from that, you know, still the role of the norepinephrine and serotonin, and low levels of norepinephrine and serotonin are still the primary mechanisms and theory behind why depression occurs. And the reason we strongly feel that way is because we do know with the medications that we use to treat depression, such as, for example, fluoxetine or paroxetine or the citalopram, the classical medicines that we use to treat depression, typically increase levels of serotonin. Some of the antidepressant medicines also increase levels of norepinephrine in the brain. And that's the theory for why these antidepressant medications work to improve mood and anxiety. So there is still a neurotransmitter role, a biological component, along with some of the behavioral and other stresses that may be involved with why this occurs in the summertime for some folks.
So generally, when we're talking about this disorder, is this something that would begin in the summer and end in the fall kind of thing? It would kind of go away if it was left to its own devices?
Typically, yes. Because in this subset of, and it is a small subset of folks, it's typically associated with longer daylight and warmer weather and hotter weather. So, yeah, typically it would be associated with, right. So it would be end of spring through the summer months and ending at the end of summer or beginning of fall. Typically.
Okay. So that's kind of how we would identify it, if there's that onset when the summer begins, then we know. Because it's kind of hard to tell sometimes where your anxiety or depression or, you know, fatigue is actually coming from. We can blame it on so many things. So how do we know that, you know, other than the timing of the onset of it, how do we know that this is what we're dealing with?
Yeah, so typically I would look for a noticeable change in your friend or loved one's behavior. So if they're typically, let's say your friend, let's call him Joey. If Joey is typically a outgoing social kind of person most of the year, but then all of a sudden in the summer you notice that Joey is staying to himself more, staying home more, not really going out with you to hang out or whatever on the weekends, and maybe not even, just kind of isolating, maybe not talking to you much. And when you do talk to Joey, he's kind of more irritable. And And some of the other symptoms that I had mentioned previously, if you notice that Joey is having changes in his sleep, maybe he's sleeping all the time, or most of the day, or maybe not sleeping enough, or if he, a weight change can be a concern as well. So, and that weight could go up or down depending on whether Joey's appetite increases or decreases when he's depressed. So that would be another thing to look out for, is a change in Joey's weight. And energy, concentration, maybe even there may be some noticeable changes if Joey is going to work or school. There may be some concerns, let's say for work, for example, maybe some concerns from bosses that maybe Joey's not showing up to work, coming in late, work performance is not very good. He's not as productive. Or in school, something we would be looking for is some of those similar things, such as maybe showing up late to class or being absent a lot to school, or a change in grades would be another concern. So if Joey typically is a pretty good to average student, and all of a sudden grades are, for example, if Joey goes to summer school, of course, I know a lot of folks don't go to school in the summer, but there are some people that go to school in the summer. So if there are some, you know, if Joey's all of a sudden having going from A's and B's to D's and F's, then that's a concern as well for seasonal affective disorder or seasonal depression.
Okay. Got it. So other than, so as we said, you know, it will generally end at, you know, when the season is over. But and I would imagine this is kind of a relatively new study. So what percentage of the population might develop this or suffer from this?
Yeah, from what we know, so about 5 to 8% of the population can have seasonal affective disorder, which the most common season for folks to have it is in the winter months. So that would be basically about 90% of those folks who have seasonal affective disorder would have it in the winter months. There's a very small subset, as I mentioned, 10% of folks that are felt to have it more in the summer months or in the reverse pattern. So and so because it is so relatively rare, we really don't hear about it as much, or maybe it's not noticed as much because many folks are going out and having fun in the summer, going on vacation, and may not realize that a loved one is struggling with this.
That's true. That's absolutely true. So it just seems hard. So at what point would we want to consult with a psychiatrist about this?
Yeah, if you as we were kind of discussing the example of Joey, if you notice any significant changes in mood or behavior, as I mentioned before, sleep, appetite, fatigue, low self-esteem, irritability, changes in weight.
Right.
Now, those would all be concerning for seasonal depression. But the most concerning symptom typically is always the safety issue. So, if we're continuing on with the Joey example, so if Joey is starting to have thoughts of hurting himself or wishing he was dead, or that maybe life would be better off. Maybe everyone would be better off without him. When he starts to have those kinds of suicidal thoughts, that's really concerning, and that's definitely where a friend or a loved one should seek professional help for Joey, because that starts to go into a safety concern where Joey could potentially hurt himself or hurt somebody else. And that's where I would get more concerned. Now, and that's more of the extreme kind of life-threatening symptom to look out for. Joey may not outright say that he's having thoughts about hurting himself. You know, so that may be a question that a close friend or a loved one may even need to to ask him, because he may be so ashamed that he's having those kinds of thoughts and feel so selfish for having those thoughts that he may not tell anyone. So that is a question that sometimes needs to be asked. But even aside from that, if you're noticing any of the other symptoms that I mentioned before, I would be concerned about seasonal affective disorder and seasonal depression. And he would need to see a mental health professional. And that could be a psychiatrist. It could be a therapist or a professional counselor. So there's lots of help available. It's a matter of kind of reaching out. And if Joey doesn't have the energy to or motivation to do that, then someone who really cares about him could help support him and look for resources in the area. And it could be – so the difference between a psychiatrist and a psychotherapist typically is a psychiatrist is a physician, typically went to medical school. And they're trained and specialized in diagnosing and treating mental health disorders. Typically, their focus is more on medications, although some of them do psychotherapy as well. So therapists or psychotherapists are typically folks that have not been to medical school, so they may have different sorts of degrees. So it could be a licensed professional counselor. It could be a licensed clinical social worker or LCSW. It could be a PsyD or a doctorate in psychology or PhD. So there's lots of different credentials that could be involved with for folks that do therapy. And they typically, because they haven't gone to medical school, they typically they don't prescribe medication. They focus on just the psychotherapy piece, which in this case, since we're talking about seasonal affective disorder, is typically going to be cognitive behavioral therapy, which really, would you like me to go into that, Randy, at this point, as far as
I actually talk about that a lot, and the limitations of cognitive behavioral therapy. So. So that would not apply, right?
Okay. I'm sorry. What was that?
So that would not be. So if a person was suffering from Somerset, that would not be beneficial to them. Because that's not what they need, right? Is that what you're going to say, or did I?
No. Actually, I cognitive behavioral therapy is still evidence-based treatment for depression and anxiety. So it's still going to be a recommended treatment because you're still focusing on the negative cognitions and all that. So do you have different feelings on cognitive behavioral therapy? I'm willing to hear your thoughts on that.
Oh yeah. it works for several things. It just doesn't work for what I do because I deal with people who have suffered narcissistic abuse. And those who go for cognitive behavioral therapy get worse, and they end up coming to me. And the reason is because they have no ownership in the behavior of in their behavior or their reaction. They have no ownership whatsoever. So they're basically victims. And in cognitive behavioral therapy, they are not. That's not the first thing that is put forward. In other words, they won't say, okay, you've been victimized, this has nothing to do with you. It'll be, well, let's try to figure out, you know, how this relationship works, how we can make it better. And in these situations, it cannot get better. The only thing you can do when you have a relationship with a narcissist is run. Just get away.
Right,
because it's not going to get any better. So that's... So I was sort of putting my bias on that I shouldn't do that. I really shouldn't do that. So, but considering what you said about the nature of this disorder and what it's actually affecting, it sounds to me like medication would kind of be the only thing to really get rid of it. Because by the time you go through the therapy, the summer will be over. and you know, and
yeah,
you know.
I see your point. But also that being said, most antidepressant medicines typically take at a minimum 3 to 4 weeks to start working. I typically recommend the combination of psychiatric medication or antidepressant and psychotherapy just to kind of in all the studies that I've seen so far, the combination treatment of medication and therapy has always yielded the best results for treating depression and anxiety, as opposed to mono therapy, meaning just medication or just psychotherapy.
Now there's
a lot of nuances there. And we could spend all day talking about the nuances. But typically for mild depression, most folks would be would improve with just the psychotherapy piece. Usually, when we're going into more moderate to severe depression, that's where the combination of medication and therapy could yield the most benefit. I still do feel that there is value in psychotherapy, and maybe cognitive behavioral therapy has there's the evidence base behind it. So you hear a lot about it read a lot about it when you go into treatment of depression. I mean, but there are other psychotherapy modalities that could be used to, you know, supportive therapy as well. And if there's any marital struggles or conflict, you know, marital therapy could help as well. So there's lots of different ways to approach the therapy piece. It may not have to be just cognitive behavioral therapy, but that's one that many folks would read about or hear about. So that was why I mentioned
right.
it.
Exactly. So when someone comes into your office with this, because the symptoms that you mentioned, you know, the agitation, anxiety, fatigue, the eating too much, too little, weight change, somatic issues, that could be so many different things. So if this is a kind of a rare disorder, would a psychiatrist look for this first, or how would you go about figuring out what this is related to? And I guess the thing to ask would be, when does it start and when does it stop? But, you know, people aren't always that aware of that kind of thing, the onset and the ending.
Yeah, and the patient themselves may not realize it. A lot of times, even with the wintertime seasonal affective disorder, typically when we're if the mental health professional is getting a good history, we would typically want to ask if there's a seasonal pattern to their depression. So, for example, since the wintertime one is the most common, we would be looking for, you know, if someone is saying, okay, they're coming in November, December, and they're saying that, you know, they're all the symptoms we talked about with depression, and they say, you know, I've noticed I only feel this way during the wintertime months, and the rest of the year I feel perfectly fine, perfectly normal, and this has been going on for me for years and years, that I just feel depressed only in the wintertime and I haven't noticed any other problems. So that's kind of, and since we're talking about the summertime one, it kind of applies in the summer too. So we're looking for a seasonal pattern to the symptoms. And really you have to go back through the history to really see, has this been happening during the summer months for the last couple of years or longer, you know, to really understand if this is really a seasonal affective disorder piece. Yeah.
Okay. In winter SAD, we can use the light box, and that can really help. So that's something we can do for ourselves at home. So if we're feeling it, you know, I mean, that's what I did. I didn't consult with a doctor. I just read about it, went and bought a light box and used it. what can we do for ourselves in the summer?
Yeah, so summertime, yeah, it's a little trickier, right? And the light box is, you're right, the light box is going to be the recommended treatment for winter SAD. So you absolutely did the right thing summertime's a little tougher. Basically, doing your best to kind of avoid there's a lot of things, but avoiding, so sometimes being outside in the heat can worsen the symptoms, and the bright light too can sometimes worsen the symptoms for folks. So kind of limiting the sunlight and heat exposure can help as well.
I guess getting back on a normal schedule, making sure you're sleeping, going to sleep at the same time, waking at the same time, getting your rhythm back.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's going to be the other piece. Thank you. that's where I was at. So yeah, so that was one of the pieces that I mentioned. Is kind of it's a kind of a chaotic schedule in the summer. So doing your best to maintain a routine for yourself in the summertime is going to be important. So as you mentioned, so going to sleep at the same time every night, waking up at the same time every morning, creating as much of a schedule for yourself as you can during the summer months can also help.
Yeah, that sounds like, you know, those things, avoiding the sun and the heat and all that stuff. I mean, I've actually heard people tell me, you know, I'm just allergic to the summertime. So I've come across people who really don't feel well in the summer. You know, so I can recognize this. I don't hear it a lot, but I have in my lifetime heard people say
that.
I'm like, how can you feel bad in the summertime? But see, now I understand. So tell us some about the work that you do and your, you have the Saranga Comprehensive Psychiatry. Tell us about that. Tell us about
thanks for asking. So I'm actually I'm a child, adolescent, adult psychiatrist. So I treat all ages, I have a private office in Apex, North Carolina, which is just outside, is a kind of a suburb of Raleigh, and also I work part time. I'm medical director of community mental health agency called Easter Seals, which has several clinics throughout North Carolina, outpatient clinics where we treat primarily folks who have Medicaid, Medicare, and uninsured. So that's kind of the population that Easter Seals primarily, and it's a non-profit agency. So that's kind of the patient population we're trying to help throughout in clinics throughout the state, in our outpatient clinics, and we have some intensive in-home services for children and teenagers. And also we treat what's called severe and persistently mental ill population, which is mainly folks with schizophrenia, schizoaffective disorder, bipolar disorder, through what's called ACT teams. So ACT stands for Assertive Community Treatment Teams, which is basically a community-based model of treating these folks that struggle with pretty severe mental illness. And it's a model in which the psychiatrist, therapist, nurse visits the patient's home on a regular weekly basis or more. And so it's a pretty intensive service. So that's kind of – so between a medical director for Easter Seals and my private office in Apex, so I'm treating kind of the wide variety of mental illness.
Well, that's good. I mean, it keeps you more interested. It's hard to just keep doing the same thing over and over. You know, I want to talk a little bit, and this is off the topic, but it's something I come across a lot or hear about a lot, and that is bipolar disorder and how often, and I think we might have talked about this last time, but bipolar disorder is so often misdiagnosed, and I've had people come to me that have been diagnosed with it, put on medication, you know, and it's just not the right thing, because abuse, the abuse syndrome can mimic or mirror a bipolar disorder, because the emotions are all over the place. So what exactly is bipolar? Let's clear that up.
Okay. So bipolar disorder is it's a disorder of mood, which why it's called bipolar is because there's two poles that we're talking about. So there's the manic phase or manic episode and the depressive episode. Those are the two. So the manic phase is the up phase, and the depressive episode is the down phase of this disorder. So bipolar disorder. So, and it can get complicated in how much, because there's really two main types of bipolar disorder. There's a bipolar 1 and there's a bipolar 2 disorder. So bipolar 1 has a typical a manic episode, which I didn't define it yet, but it's basically an episode lasting typically at least a week of elevated mood, on top of the world happy, needing less sleep, kind of go for several days at a time, talking a mile a minute, being engaged in a lot of different activities, never finishing anything, some risky behavior sometimes. And those episodes typically alternate with depressive episodes, which last typically at least 2 weeks, which we've discussed a lot of the symptoms already, so I won't rehash that with the changes in sleep and appetite and all that.
Right.
So that's the type 1 bipolar disorder. There's also something called bipolar disorder type 2, which the main difference there is that instead of having the full-blown manic episode that I was describing, it's what's called a hypomanic episode. So it's like a toned-down version of what I described as a manic episode to be. So it's typically at least 4 days of some of those symptoms that I mentioned, but not. It typically doesn't last. It's typically 4 days to a week, so it doesn't last as long as the classic manic episode that I mentioned. And it's kind of a toned-down version of those symptoms that I described. And it's not typically, the hypomanic episode is not typically as impairing to functioning for a person as the full-blown manic episode. These can be very difficult diagnoses. It can be difficult to diagnose, because most folks spend most of their lifetime will be in the depressive phase. So the only way you would find out really if they've had a hypomanic or manic episode in the past is first seeing them in that episode, which is hard to do because they're rarely in those episodes, or getting a good history and the patient may not even realize that they were having those episodes, because a lot of folks who are in a hypomanic or manic phase love it, because, you know, if you think about it, I mean, you have all this energy, you're super happy, life is great, you're not needing to sleep much, and you feel like you're getting a lot done, but you're really not. So a lot of folks really love that energy that goes along with the hypomanic or manic episodes. So it's really the family members that would often recognize those episodes if you ask the family members about it. So it can be very difficult it can be a challenge to diagnose, unless you've taken a careful history. But also the treatment is different, because if you prescribe an antidepressant to someone who has bipolar disorder, the antidepressant medication could switch them over into a hypomanic or manic episode. So the treatment and medications that we use are different, and we typically use what's called mood stabilizers to treat bipolar disorder. So, yeah, it's sort of a different beast from what we've been talking about, but it is still related, because you still have the depressive episode that we've been talking about all along, so this morning, but you're kind of throwing in this excessively happy or excessively irritable, on top of the world kind of mood episode into the mix with it.
Gotcha. Got you. That makes sense. So it's not like a roller coaster ride like people would think. It's not like up and down and up and down. No, there's episodes that last for, you know, a couple of weeks at a time that you'll, mm-hmm. you know, you'll see a pattern. It doesn't sound like there's really a gray area. They go from high to low or low to high.
Well, yeah, this is where it can get kind of a little complicated, Randy, because there is also something called cyclothymic disorder. I don't know have you heard of it before or read about it?
No.
Before. So basically, in cyclothymic disorder, it's kind of, and it's a relatively rare disorder, so it's not commonly diagnosed. But in that disorder, the folks have the combination of the hypomanic episode with a milder depression. So they're kind of, so there can be some of the mood swings that you're describing, but it is relatively rare. So it's kind of a hypomania along with kind of a mild to moderate depression in
okay.
between. So it can get complicated. So that's another reason why diagnosing bipolar disorder is it's tricky and challenging. So and the presentation sometimes doesn't follow the textbook sometimes. So there are some nuances there to it, and it's not often just a cookie cutter kind of thing as far as diagnosing bipolar disorder.
Okay, but it seems to be a cookie cutter thing for many doctors to just slap that diagnosis on it. I've heard it so many times.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
So we are running out of time.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is unfortunate. It's just unfortunate to, you know, we don't want to slap a diagnosis on someone who does not have that diagnosis and, you know, make them think that they're mentally ill in that way. So anyway, we are out of time, but it's been great having you back. Thank you for all the information. It's really great. It's rare, but I do recommend people see psychiatrists from time to time because, you know, when they're just not getting any better sometimes, it's because there's a chemical imbalance or something's, you know, wrong that where they may need medication. But there's a stigma about seeing a psychiatrist. People don't like that word. We have to get through that. excuse me. But thank you for educating us because that helps us to understand why it's important at times for us to see a psychiatrist. So it's been wonderful talking to
thanks.
You.
Thank you, Randy. And if I could just take a moment, just to, along with that, we're not, just to keep in mind, we're not all psychiatrists are pill pushers. So at least I'm not. So I know that's kind of the stigma associated with it is that if you go to a psychiatrist, he or she is going to prescribe a medication for you. We're not, at least I'm not like that. And I think a lot of my colleagues are not like that too. So we really only want to prescribe medication if we think it's going to be helpful for the situation and if it's absolutely necessary. Because medications have side effects. So, and medications don't help for everything. So they can be helpful for some scenarios as we described, but the medications can't fix everything. So
good. So you take a more conservative approach. That's great.
I do.
So anyway, it's great talking to you and, have a good time. Have a great day.
If you
come up with another topic, you can have Mike Larson contact me again.
All right.
And we'll
good.
Talk
Thank
about it. We'll have another
Thank
talk.
You.
Okay. Have a great
well,
day.
I would be happy to. I'd be happy
okay.
to. Take care.
Have
Bye.
A great day. Thanks. Bye-bye. We are out of time. But if you have any comments or questions, you can email me at loveyourlife@randyfine.com. That's loveyourlife at R-A-N-D-I. Fine.com. On Friday the 27th, I have Julie Ryan on. Julie will be talking about what really happens as we transition from this life into the next. Very, very interesting. So I'm looking forward to talking about that, and that will be the 27th of September, 11 a.m. Eastern. I look forward to seeing you then. May joy and serenity always be yours. Goodbye.